Hi, I'm here with Brian Linder, AIA of the Value of Architecture. With a background in high-end custom residential design and construction and a master's degree in architecture, Brian Linder provides unique expertise to the buying and selling of estates, architectural properties, and historic residences. Brian has represented some of the most notable properties, probably profitable also, around Los Angeles, including work by Rudolf Schindler, Angela Graham, Cope Himmelblau, and Eric Owen Moss. In addition, Brian's understanding of business and complex real estate transactions has enabled him to assist buyers in finding value for their money at every level of spending. Brian has also helped owners and developers market distinctive properties from land with plans through construction of speculative ventures. Brian Linder has built his real estate practice around a concept he calls the value of architecture. This concept is based on the notion that architectural design adds significant value to real property in terms of intangible lifestyle benefits, the premium paid for architectural properties, and the fact that architectural homes tend to be less sensitive to market fluctuations. Brian leads the ongoing UCLA Extension course, The Value of Architecture, and has further developed his thesis in presentations to the American Institute of Architects, the Society of Architectural Historians, and various local and national audiences. Brian is also committed to promoting architecture as art, featuring the work of practicing architects on his website, www.tvoa.net, including Marmal Radziner, Pewin Scarpa, and Patrick Tai. And he's a member of local, state, and national association of realtors, an active member of the American Institute of Architects, certified by the National Council of Architectural Registration Boards, Master of Architecture degree from UCLA, Bachelor of Science in Business Administration from Carnegie Mellon University, and a licensed architect, general contractor, and real estate broker. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Michelle.
Quite an impressive resume there. Many, many degrees and certifications.
All licensed up and nowhere to go.
So how did you kind of go into real estate brokerage instead of kind of the traditional practice of architecture? You started in traditional practice of architecture and then kind of moved into this other aspect of the profession.
I think I've always had kind of a different vision of, well, it's not really that different. I mean, my vision was the architect as the master builder back in the day. And when I finished my Master of Architecture degree in 93, there was a shortage of architecture jobs because mm-hmm. it was a recession. And I got my general contractor's license at the same time. And I really wanted to go into building. You mm-hmm. know, I wanted to be on site. I love the construction site. And so I worked with general contractors building architect designed homes for about 10 years as a superintendent project manager. Uh-huh. And with enough work in architects' offices to become licensed and to have my, you know, NCARB certification. But I think that after doing that for 10 years, I started to become really frustrated with sort of the adult babysitting aspect of construction management. Uh-huh. You know, I became really frustrated with the idea that we're no longer in an era of crafts and guilds where people work their way up through an apprenticeship program mm-hmm. and someone purporting to be a finished carpenter is actually a finished carpenter. And so I just got really tired of kind of having to look over people's shoulders to make sure things were plumb and level and mm-hmm. square. And, you know, yeah. it just became really not fun for me anymore. Uh-huh. And I never really wanted to work in an architect's office. I don't really like office work a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And so that wasn't something that appealed to me. And when I did work with architects, I worked, you know, just enough to be licensed and just felt like I didn't see myself there as well. And I started thinking about real estate as the finished product.
Yeah.
That really that's where people are selling architecture. And there was one firm in Los Angeles then known as Mosler, Deasy & Doe. And since the 70s, they really had been marketing architecture as, you know, or real estate, architecture as art, the, you know, the art value of real estate. And so they had an ad in the Saturday supplements of the LA Times, and they were the only firm then in the 90s that would even use the word architect. And so their full page ad always had a unique piece of architecture and the word architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And I got my broker's license and called them and said, "Hey, I have a broker's license and I'd love to work with you guys." And they said, "Sure, come on in." And I began, you know, hanging my license with them.
Uh-huh.
And so in a way, it feels as though if I had set out to design my career path like this, like if there had been intention to it, I would be happy to have ended up here mm-hmm. because I really love what I do. And I feel very fortunate that, you know, every day I get to look at great architecture and meet with interesting people who love art and architecture.
Yeah.
And I kind of can't believe I get paid to do this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, coming from a business degree undergrad and then loving architecture and studying it at the graduate level, it just is a synthesis of all of these interests of mine. Mm-hmm. You know, the psychology of deal making and watching people behave the way they do. You'd think I designed it that way, but really it was much more happenstance, the way my career path developed.
Yeah, it never is like a kind of like a straight path.
No.
Typically. So you got a Bachelor of Science. When did you go to Carnegie Mellon?
I was there in the early 80s. I graduated in 85. And so I have a Bachelor of Science in what they call industrial management, which I love because, you know, Pittsburgh was the kind of industrial heartland, you know, back in the day.
Yeah. I grew up there. Did you know that?
I don't think I did. No. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but we actually moved. We moved. My stepdad was a design engineer and designed printing presses. And so they were kind of shutting down everything. And so, you know, he had this job offer on the West Coast. So he kind of took it. And that was in 81.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's something I'm sure we could talk about for hours because mm-hmm. I had an interesting experience. I was born there and lived there until I was 8. And then I went back to college there, you know, 10 years later. But in growing up in Pittsburgh and Shadyside and Squirrel Hill and Oakland and the surrounds, I mean, it was very much of a little village existence. And so my family and my extended family and my mother's aunts and uncles and everybody lived almost within walking distance.
Yes.
And, you know, my grandmother in particular was one of 11 children and, mm-hmm. you know, a big family. And all of their children and children's children were all there in the late 70s and early 80s. And then, as you mentioned, it's like when economic policies changed, there was this diaspora from the Rust Belt. And I have one half sister living there and one second cousin from that whole family tree on both sides, and nobody is in Pittsburgh anymore.
Yeah, I know. So. Well, people will always ask me, I mean, somebody just the other day said on Facebook, like, oh, why don't you come home to, you know, Pittsburgh and we can go to lunch? I'm like, home to Pittsburgh? Like, I've only been there like three times since I moved, right? Since 1982, right? My family moved here, then I moved back there to finish up my senior year of high school, and then I came out here, and I only have been back like three times the entire time. So
that makes sense.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you know, and I just, right, it's like, what, the 40th reunion or something. And I said, no, I'm still not going back. And I said, if anybody wants to see me, they can come and see me here. Which, you know, nobody comes, right? They'll go to Vegas. They won't venture into California.
I know. I was talking with someone earlier today, actually, about Pittsburgh and how it's almost like a standalone community that people feel like they don't really have to leave Pittsburgh because they're great cultural institutions
museums, I mean, it's true. And theater. Yeah. And,
you know, why would I go somewhere else? So there's an aspect that... This was someone else, a guy from here that went to Carnegie Mellon and studied fine art. And mm-hmm. he was saying his friends there were just like never going to leave.
No. I mean,
there's some charm to Pittsburgh.
Oh, yeah. No, there definitely is. I was in the South Hills, so it was a little bit different. But I was in Dormont. And, I mean, my great-grandparents. Oh, I mean, when they immigrated from Slovakia on the other side, they built a house there. And the house is still there. But there's other things that have grown up around it. But yeah, it was this. It's like less than 1 square mile. It's a suburb, super dense suburb. It got the trolley.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, you know, I grew up there and left and didn't go back. But
I went back, and then the day after I graduated from CMU, I threw all my stuff in the car and drove to Los Angeles. And I've never been back.
And I've met other people from Pittsburgh that did like the same thing. You know, my friend Craig like moved out here from, you know, there. And then he He eventually moved back, but now he's in Philadelphia, but it's kind of the same thing. So,
yeah.
So what are your first recollections of experiencing architecture?
You know, I mean, honestly, it's things like the old homestead works, mm-hmm. you know, the industrial architecture of steel mills.
Mm-hmm.
I remember growing up, and even when I went back to CMU my first year, you know, you could drive in the hills and look down at the river and these cooling molten ingots of steel, you know, coming out of these big smoke belching factories. And I experienced that and really continue to experience that as architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of my favorite things to do when I'm traveling is to, you know, break into old electrical power plants. And, you know, I was trying to get into the U.S. steel plant in Gary, Indiana, the last time I was there visiting my daughter in Chicago. And I just love that kind of industrial architecture where form and function are completely integrated. I mean, it looks like what it is, you know, oil refineries. I mean, I love oil refineries and, you know, gantry cranes like down at the port. But I mean, really, that's one of the things that comes to mind. And I think also, you know, buildings like the Cathedral of Learning.
My
stepfather was a professor who he got his PhD at the University of Pittsburgh. And so I remember visiting him there, and it was, you know, a Gothic cathedral skyscraper. And so that had a big impact on me. And, you know, those kinds of buildings, and really just being a kid and playing. I didn't play with the Froebel blocks like Schindler did and others in the European tradition. But, I mean, I played with blocks and, you know, used to love to sit out in the front yard on Hastings Street in East Liberty. Not really East Liberty. It was Point Breeze.
Yes,
you know,
Point Breeze.
Point Breeze. Yeah. And I could walk up to my neighborhood kindergarten and elementary school, but playing around with cars in the front yard in the dirt, you know, making little roads and doing urban design at, you know, a minute level. Those experiences really impacted my desire to later study architecture. And I mean, when I submitted my portfolio, I hadn't studied architecture, and I was coming into, you know, applying to the 3-year Master of Architecture first professional degree programs. And so I had to submit an art portfolio of paintings and drawings and creative work. But I also submitted photos of myself as a 5-year-old in Pittsburgh standing next to these block buildings that were taller than I was and little cityscapes in the dirt. I think those were kind of seminal experiences for me, really. And then later, really moving back to Pittsburgh as an 18-year-old and experiencing downtown and those buildings that there's so much history in Pittsburgh from the turn of the 20th century, that was really influential. Because when we left Pittsburgh, we moved to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and that's a pretty rural place except for the University of Alabama. Yeah. And so moving back to Pittsburgh, it was like, wow, a big city. You know? So, which is funny, then having later experienced Philadelphia and New York, of course. But for me, Pittsburgh was a big city.
I mean, it is very urban as far as, I mean, but then also I think that it's a downtown that is used a lot by like younger people. Like we used to take the trolley into, at a fairly young age, we were allowed to take the trolley into town or the bus. I mean, so we were probably like 12 or 13.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we would just take the trolley and just go down and you know, we would go to Kaufman's department store, you know, of Kaufman's of
Frank
Falling
Lloyd
Water.
Wright
And then there was, you know, Mellon Square. I mean, my grandmother used to take me to Mellon Square with all the fountains and everything that was like that, you know, that urban plaza that was up the...
Right. Next to Mellon Bank, right?
And in front of William Penn Hotel.
Yeah, it sort of reminds me of Los Angeles and the Biltmore and the awful Ricardo Legarreta Plaza here. You know, it's sort of the same kind of thing. Like you would park under it and come out. And that Mellon Bank building. And what was the one with the TV-looking shapes on it that is good modern architecture. It's, I can't remember who the architect is, but I mean, there's some really great modern architecture in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And classical architecture, historical classical
architecture. Oh, yeah, and all the brick buildings. You know, I tell people, like, I didn't go to Falling Water when I was there. You know, I didn't go to Falling Water until I went back there, you know, married and with a kid, and we were going to a wedding, and we're like, oh, let's go to Falling Water, you know? Right. And so we went to see it. I mean, all of my thing was kind of like this brick building from the downtown Pittsburgh area. You know, that was kind of like my recollections of, you know, or even Station Square, rehabbing these old buildings. And I used to always think like, oh, you know, like going by on the trolley or whatever, like, oh, what would, you know, how cool would it be if, like, we could do something with this old building? And, you know, I mean, of course, they did do a lot of things like that with the areas. But.
And then how about, like, the Civic Auditorium, you know, which was that sort of space age dome that the dome retracted and...
Oh, but you know, that they tore down.
Did that get torn down? Yes, oh, that's sort of too bad.
I know, because it's really it was so too iconic, bad. You know? Oh, definitely. Yeah, the Civic Arena. Yeah, yeah, I went to go see... I saw a bunch of concerts in there. In fact, the other weird thing, I don't know why they had... But they had... Edward Villella, like, was there as a... I mean, he was a ballet dancer, and for some reason they had him in the Civic Arena, which I have no idea why you would have a ballet in the Civic Arena, but that's where I saw him perform, like one of his last performances. So.
That's surprising. Yeah, you think it would be at Heinz Hall?
Exactly.
Or something.
I have no idea why they decided to. Yeah, they tore it down like several years ago.
But that makes me think also of the Carnegie Museum. You know, I think that was an influential piece of classical architecture that really influenced me as a child. I remember going there and just loving the dinosaurs, of course, and the La Brea tar pits exhibits. And when I moved to Los Angeles, my first apartment was on Wilshire and Burnside in Miracle Mile. And I moved into this apartment and the next day went for a walk down Wilshire Boulevard, and there are the La Brea tar pits. And I'm like, oh my God, this is like all of the bones in the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh came from the La Brea tar pits.
Really? So, I didn't know that they were. I had like no idea when people were talking about the La Brea. Obviously, I didn't read much of the exhibits. I was just looking
somehow that
at
hit
it.
My radar then. I mean, I remember that, the La Brea tar pits. I didn't have it. I thought I had no idea where that might be, but
I mean, they did have a really extensive dinosaur collection. I mean, I think that was like, you know what I mean, a lot of those little dioramas. Everything. Yeah, that I was totally entranced with. Yeah, just like, you know, with that movie, what is it?
Like Jurassic Park or something?
No, the movie that is about them being at night at the museum or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, spending the night and the animals coming alive.
Yeah, and all the people and everything coming alive. Yeah, right. that museum was pretty much like that. And then we would go to the art museum too, the Carnegie Art.
Right, which is pretty world class. I remember going back to that, to the Carnegie International once from here, you know, for their every 4-year contemporary art show, which was pretty great. And so those were early influences. And then, you know, my first real girlfriend at CMU was an architect.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the art fine arts building at CMU is a neoclassical building.
Yes, I have.
You know, architecture is considered to be the mother of the fine arts. Certainly in that context, it was like, you know, art, architecture, music, dance. I forget, you know, how it was in the lintels of the building spelled out. And so, you know, that relationship and reading the Fountainhead as a, you know, an 18-year-old was, you know, those were early influences where I became more informed, I think. And then when I was 19, took my first trip to Europe, and that kind of, you know, my interest in architecture grew from there.
Yeah. One of my good friends from high school is a design major at CMU, so I went to go visit her one time and sat in on the class and everything.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I thought was missing from my experience at UCLA. When I studied architecture at UCLA, it was the Graduate School of Architecture and Urban Planning. And I always thought that was sort of sad because I viewed urban planners as people who would have benefited from just getting an MBA and making more money, perhaps, or doing what they did ultimately and becoming part of the School of Public Policy. And then architecture became part of the College of Fine Arts at UCLA, but it's always remained in its own building. So there was never any of that cross-pollination that I observed in the architecture and fine arts studios in the fine arts building at CMU. You know, there was a real richness there with people, artists and architects interacting with one another in that context.
Yeah. They just changed to have the School of Architecture. The College of Environmental Design also includes art. But before, when we went to school there, it did not include art.
Right.
There. Yeah, but they actually had a home ec program that was in the same building as the...
That's funny. Sorry, and where was that? Where did you study?
At Cal Poly Pomona.
That's funny. Yeah. Architecture and home ec.
And home ec, yeah. So you had architecture, planning, landscape architecture, and then home ec. They weren't like part of ours, but they were in baking, the same building. Know? Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, which, you know, I did like love to sew and do all of that stuff, but it's like I didn't think that it warranted, you know, a degree. I mean, they're really life skills to me. Yeah. And then it's like home handicrafts or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so we would be, you know, and I mean, of course, this is totally mean towards any home ec majors out there that might be listening to this podcast, which I doubt there are any. But anyway, that we would be, you know, going out after just having taken a structures exam, and then they were like talking about how they had their sewing machine test that they had just had to do, and they would do like napkin folding and stuff in there, and you know, and of course, we're just like, oh.
We had our grueling table setting final on Thursday.
Where does the fork go? Yeah. I don't know. So what are three classic buildings that you like and why?
Well, three things that come to mind. I mean, certainly this is a fluid thought process for me. And it kind of reminds me of the security questions that you have online where, you know, who is your favorite artist? Like, well, when? In what context? You know what I mean? And so today, thinking about your question, I was thinking about, the Pantheon. I mean, well, let me say, actually, I would say Sagrada Familia, you know, the Gaudi project in Barcelona comes to mind first, because that's really one of the buildings I experienced on my first trip to Europe as a 19-year-old. And, what I loved about that was that I went in there. I mean, I've done a lot of breaking and entering as an adult onto architecture sites like the Roman Forum in the dark after hours, or Sagrada Familia in the dark after hours, and just climbing around that building in those towers and just experiencing that architecture as a teenager was really influential. And, you know, some of the things I loved about it, I learned about later, like the fact that the arches were constructed by hanging weighted ropes upside down.
You know, I did not even realize that until somebody told me that, like, several months ago or something. I was laughing. I said, "But I never do that." They're like, "Oh, yeah." I'm like, "What? I didn't know that." Obviously, that's something else I didn't read.
Right. But you experience it, you know, and it's the same thing with some of the... They weren't really buried in the masonry, per se, but they were carved into the stone, just everyday objects and, you know, sort of fruits and vegetables and animals. And it was a very playful, whimsical, unconventional piece of architecture that was, I guess, for me, very experiential. Mm-hmm. And so that was influential. And then later, you know, I didn't visit the Pantheon on that trip, but later when I did, I found that to be a very inspirational building from the standpoint, sort of spiritually. It's intriguing that it was a temple to all the gods, you know, and it was kind of an embracing concept. And I love the oculus in the Pantheon. And so when you're in there, I remember being in there on a New Year's Eve, and it was raining through the oculus. And so you know, you see during the day the path of the sun traveling on the ecliptic and what it does inside a space like that with an oculus open to the sky. But then to be able to look at the sky and see the clouds moving and then the rain coming down into the space, in a way it kind of reminds me of a James Turrell sky space. You know, a framed opening for viewing the sky. And then there are all these other things that are underneath that that I'm not intelligent enough to be able to articulate, like the golden mean and the scale and proportions that others have analyzed that have significant meaning subconsciously, I think, that, you know, you may not be able to pick up on it and articulate it intellectually, but sort of experientially, I think those kinds of design decisions enter the subconscious in a way that's very influential.
Yeah, yeah. And as far as your perception of space and human scale, which is funny because, you know, it's like rarely do I do two podcast interviews on it, but, you know, earlier with Mark, I mean, maybe it's something in the air, but we were kind of talking about the same thing. I mean, he brought up the thing about how it was raining really heavily at St. Peter's one time and just how there was like so much rain coming down, but all of that rain coming off of the roof there, because it's such a huge building.
Right, it's like a waterfall.
Exactly. Wow. It was just gushing out of the gargoyles, and it was just so loud, you know, and now you're kind of bringing up the Pantheon and the rain and everything, but and also, like, kind of this perception of how we experience space and how you really can't kind of teach that. It's more inborn, and then also how that's kind of, like, lost with you know, with viewing things on a computer instead of viewing them in real life, you know, how that you're not gaining that kind of spatial awareness when you're looking at a computer.
True, and it really, things get lost in that translation. Yes. Things that can't be communicated two-dimensionally.
Yes.
And, you know, that makes me think of Schindler, and there's a new documentary of Rudolf Schindler's work that's being released this year, and I saw a preview a couple of Friday nights ago at the Schindler House on King's Road, and one of the comments was, in looking at the Lovell Beach House, that his architecture doesn't translate well to the two-dimensional, because he's a space architect, and that's the name of the movie. It's like Rudolf Schindler, Space Architect, and because he was, you know, working in three-dimension in section and volume, and that doesn't communicate well in a plan drawing or an elevation drawing or even in a sectional drawing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really requires being in the space and inhabiting it three-dimensionally with the body and the eyes and, you know, even like the hands and the senses and, you know, the ears and, like, hearing how sounds behave in three-dimensional spaces. All of that stuff is lost in a two-dimensional translation.
There was have you ever been to the Louisiana Museum in Denmark?
I have not.
Well, we took the head of our, the dean of our school, he came over to visit us while we were over there, and we took him to the museum, and he was kind of laughing because he said, you know, if a student, like, showed these plans and elevations and sections, he goes, I would think that, you know, I would fail them. because in plan, section, elevation, you know, the space doesn't look very, you know, interesting. But when you're actually experiencing going through the museum and then the different levels the museum is on, and now it's kind of, you go down, then you do get these vistas of the sound out there. You know, there's water, and then there's other areas that are courtyards, and, you know, there's a, and then the plan, there's a lot of changes in the levels of the floor plan. So
And that does, even in with great architectural photography, or I would argue with virtual reality tools where you're able to sort of fly through spaces, it's still not quite the same as
it isn't. And that's also kind of what we said, you know, because a lot of people, they'll want to, well, I want to see a rendering, I want to do a fly through, and I explained, I said, you know, I can get those for you. I said, you know, it's like, but until you, I said, I've just found that until you actually experience the space, like when they're constructing it, it's you're not going to understand exactly that, you know, and not exactly that you're not going to understand, but you're going to perceive it differently than you would it in a fly through, in a rendering. You know?
True.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very true. Now I'm thinking about the Pueblo at Taos.
Mm-hmm.
That's a piece of historic architecture that I have found to be very influential. I remember being there also on a New Year's Day and looking at that architecture growing up out of the soil with Taos Mountain, you know, the sacred mountain behind mm-hmm. this handmade architecture, was really powerful and, you know, super organic and yet orthogonal. I mean, the geometries are pretty pure and yet it's completely handmade, and it's handmade out of earth. And mm-hmm. so it feels at one with the earth and like it grew up out of the earth. And that's something that really influenced Schindler's design of the King's Road house, I have come to learn.
Really?
Yeah, there were two events recently. One was a talk there called Modernism in Mud. And when Schindler was working with Frank Lloyd Wright in Chicago, he was sent out here to work on the textile block houses. And he ended up taking a trip through the Southwest and ended up, you know, visiting the Taos Pueblo. And one of the things that he liked to do with his architecture was to take the stucco right down into the ground, you know, rather than holding it up and having a weep screed or something where the foundation would be partially visible. He really liked connecting the architecture to the earth, which, as I understand it, is something that he experienced in Taos at the Pueblo. And oddly, he misattributed that to... He called that really the great American architecture that he attributed to the first immigrants, the Spanish. And I thought, how did that happen? Because he's shown, there are photos from his collection where he was personally photographing the Taos Pueblo with native people in front of the buildings. And then he attributes it to the Spanish, as if, you know, the native people were completely invisible, which I thought was funny. And, you know, just misattributed, really. That was theirs. Yeah. It wasn't the Spanish. You know, it was the Spanish who appropriated it into colonial architecture later. But,
Wright's the history, right? Yeah.
Yes, it's true. But even though he was so influenced by it, and you see it at King's Road with... You know, I have described that as very elemental architecture over the years in my experience of it, because it's sort of about the earth and the air and the fire in those, you know, there must be like seven fireplaces in there.
Mm-hmm.
And the water, the metaphoric water elements of the sunken gardens at King's Road, you know, it's very primitive, mm-hmm. you know, and yet it was built in 1922 and has often been called the first modern architecture in the world. I mean, that mm-hmm. was done really before the Europeans were doing the international style, which later became more famous at the Museum of Modern Art show mm-hmm. in New York, which Schindler wasn't a part of because he wasn't, in a way, formulaic. He wasn't practicing with that formula, mm-hmm. but he was doing this experimental space architecture that was very primitive in its origins. So I kind of like architecture like that really appeals to the senses in a primal subconscious way,
mm-hmm.
sort of a non-intellectual way.
Yeah.
You know, that you can articulate as you pick up the tools, but you can also just experience it in ways that appeal to us as human beings who have been living in caves or cliff dwellings or mm-hmm. primitive shelters for millennia. You know, to then see that incorporated into a piece of modern architecture is really exciting. And I think that, you know, the Pueblo is really an example of that. They were no longer hunting and gathering. They were cultivating and stationary, but the architecture was still very experiential and primal and organic. And again, then in the Pueblo, you know, you have the little kiva fireplace and the wood structural elements, and, you know, it's built by hand at a scale that is very human.
Yeah. Yeah, and then if you go to like Bandelier and these other places that they, you know, they exited from Montezuma's castle, and, you know, some of those other areas, you know, kind of, you can kind of see the beginnings of it, and, you know, then it kind of, you know, Chaco Canyon,
right,
all of those things.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
that's some good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it totally is. Yeah.
And I guess one other piece of architecture that, I mean, well, not really piece of architecture. I think of Japanese architecture. Mm-hmm. And so at UCLA, my master's thesis was inspired by virtual reality mm-hmm. at the time. And I was really intrigued by the notion of these alternate universes that we might be able to experience virtually.
Yeah.
And as I kind of projected forward in a sort of futurist way, I imagined that we might then become like people living in a Japanese capsule hotel, uh-huh. you know, in sort of a coffin-shaped room where yeah. we're being fed intravenously and having this virtual experience that really scared me, you know, and I kind of felt like, you know, I went to Japan and was in Tokyo for a period of time and reading a lot of science fiction and watching a lot of science fiction films and thinking a lot about virtual reality, you know, which in the early 90s was sort of such a hot topic. Yeah. And then what I ended up doing is going up into rural Honshu, into northern Japan, mm-hmm. and just going to all of these bathhouses and hot springs. And that architecture is sort of at the other end of the spectrum yeah. from virtual reality, where yeah. it's all about bathing and
yes.
hot mineral water heated yeah. by the thermal properties of the earth mm-hmm. and a human-scaled architecture, you know, with tatami mats and, you know, and then I kind of think of Katsura, the Imperial Palace, and mm-hmm. how that influenced the German modernists at the Bauhaus who were, you know, I mean, the Japanese roots of modernism, I think. I'm intrigued by that relationship, but I'm intrigued by Japanese architecture at the human scale mm-hmm. of the bathhouse.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway, those were some things that came to mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you like about being an architect?
Well, at the moment, I like having AIA after my name because I practice as a real estate broker, or what I call myself an architecture broker.
Yeah.
And that's kind of an elevator provocative kind of like, what do? Oh, I'm an architecture broker.
Yeah.
And people scratch their heads and try to figure out what that is. So it always leads to a good conversation. But I like having AIA after my name because people can see that as a real estate broker, I am an architect and I'm a knowledgeable architectural expert. Mm. But I really like having had the education. I think, you know, I don't miss practicing architecture. I mean, every now and then I think it would be fun to collaborate as a producer of architecture. You know, yeah. if money were no object and I could be the Jeff Koons of modern architecture and I would just come up with ideas and my people would draw it up and I would redline it. And, you know, I haven't gotten to that level of production, although I am kind of fascinated by that. I am not the kind of artist architect like our friend Patrick Tai or my friend MJ Neal in Austin, Texas, who his wife describes him as, like, they can't go to a motel room without him sitting in there and sketching it up and fixing all the imperfections. And Patrick's sort of like that. Like, he's an itchy architect. And, he, you know, he needs to be making creative stuff that's just coming out of his body. And, you know.
Yeah, a lot of us do. But we end up, like, you know, women end up being caregivers a lot of the time. It sucks all that life on you.
There are only so many hours in the day. I know, that's true. There are only so many hours in the day. So I like having had the education and you know, learning how to formally appreciate design and, you know, learning how to be a designer. That's one thing that I found to be interesting as an artist. You know, I consider myself a non-practicing artist. Mm-hmm. And my brother gave me paints, canvases, brushes, kind of everything I needed to start painting mm-hmm. when I was in my last corporate job after I left Deloitte. I was a management consultant at Deloitte.
Oh, okay.
And I was working at Pepsi, corporate Pepsi in San Francisco, which was uh-huh. a, you know, Fortune 50 company. And I was just ready to blow my brains out. I hated it so much. And my brother gave me paints and canvases, and I took a class at City College of San Francisco, uh-huh. which was an oil painting class. And I thought, I was like embarrassed because I thought, I don't really have a creative bone in my body. You know, I haven't taken art since third grade when I picked music and I learned to play the trumpet, and that's what I did. So I couldn't take any more art classes because it was like music or art. And so I was music.
Where were you?
Alabama. I was in Pennsylvania, in northeastern Pennsylvania.
And then
it continued in Alabama, but it was like an either or. And so I hadn't had an art class in a long time, but I realized that I could learn to do it, mm-hmm. And then I remember getting into architecture school after I took about a year and a half of prerequisites at San Francisco State, fine art classes. Uh-huh. And I was able to learn how to be an artist. And then I was able to learn how to be an architect. Mm-hmm. And, I realized when I got to architecture school that I had held architects in high esteem. And I thought all architects had good taste. And then I realized, really, most architects really don't have very good taste. Most architects are just like most people. They don't necessarily have an aesthetic driving force.
Uh-huh.
They're sort of like the accountants of the art world. They learn how to do these tools and they can, use AutoCAD or they can be great renderers, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they have a sophisticated aesthetic.
Yeah, or something. I mean, and it all kind of depends on how they design, right? I mean, like I've talked in other podcasts just about how, there are people, or just in, to other architects in general, right? There are the people in school that kind of, they would look through magazines and find, right? You're given the project and it's like, okay, design.
House in the style of.
What was it?
Well, I think of it as house in the style of. We had to do a house in the style of Lutyens, the English architect.
Which we also talked about earlier today with Mark.
Really?
It's all out there. Or just designing like a certain project, right? Like, a museum. Okay, so then people would they'd go to the resource center and get books on, the museum, or they'd look through magazines like, okay, who just did it? We're like, Richard Meyer just did this museum. I'm just going to do that. And then there were other people, right, that I probably wouldn't be in that, where you're just kind of thinking like, okay, what is my concept of the museum and what exactly am I trying? And then you're kind of building from there, right? And of course, I'd be the one like, my model wasn't finished. Like, all of my drawings weren't finished. But, I spent all of this time, right, doing, thinking about all these different ideas and things. And it's not like I couldn't get them on paper and do it. But I was, thinking conceptually about things. And that's, one of the things that I miss in practice, that I don't get a chance to think conceptually that much, because I'm so busy just trying to get projects out and their addition remodels. And you're trying to think what concept am I going to have in this? But really there still can be a concept, So I'm just saying that there were people in school that it was just like, I'm just going to reproduce this because this works. This is fine. We're going to, it's going to become my project and I'm going to move on. Right. And those people are in, a lot of them are in big corporate firms, and they rise to the top of that. I mean, there are people that I went to school with that are really good designers that are at some of the corporate firms, and then there's the people that, that we're thinking more along my lines, and we're, we're like struggling with these small practices. But I mean, I think, the way that you were in school in some ways dictates how you are as in the profession. So.
I think that's true. I mean, and that's one of the things that I found to be very disturbing in architecture school was the idea of looking at precedent.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that to be very disturbing about the legal profession, is that, that lawyers spend a lot of time looking at past decisions, and it's not very forward looking in terms of what do we want in terms of designing an ideal society. It's like, well, what did other people do in the past? And so I would watch architecture students, classmates of mine, kind of synthesize, as you say, a bunch of different magazine articles. And that would be this hodgepodge of ideas kind of thrown together. And I liked approaching it from sort of a tabula rasa standpoint,
uh-huh.
Just like blank slate, think of a new solution to a problem. And
saying, okay, I'm going to design a house that kind of like looks like a house, right? In quotations, like I said, like traditional architecture can just be beautiful, right? I mean, there are just some traditional, your house. It's beautiful.
Right. No, I love craft.
Right.
From craft. The 20s and the teens exactly. and the turn of the century.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there are those things that are, you know, just over in Santa Monica. I mean, I'm like walking to the car and there's the, is it the sandstone? What's the factory that they have kind of have on Olympic and like 17th or 18th there? There's like,
some there's like factory. A gravel plant. I think it's like it's a concrete plant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And no, that to me is that, great architecture.
I mean, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, immediately I was like, oh my gosh, like, did I ever see this before? I mean, you know, I lived here for 10 years. I don't know. And I used to drive, like, our babysitter lived on 18th Street.
Right.
You know, and my friends were at Koenig Eisenberg on, you know, 18th Street, too. And I said, like, I don't ever remember, like, seeing that before. You know, maybe there were a bunch of trees there or something, and they chopped them down. And all.
No, I think that it can be good to look at precedent to see how other people have solved problems. Mm-hmm. Because there's something that... I find I don't really like to reinvent the wheel. And when I watch someone trying to reinvent the wheel, I think that, like, hey, you could look and see how other people have solved this problem.
Yeah.
But stylistically, it really turns me off when I see designers using other designers' motifs and design aesthetic. You know, it's one thing to use programmatic elements to say, here's how a theater problem was solved, and you need the backstage and the, you know, the green rooms and the theater has to be at certain, you know, pitch and so forth.
Yeah,
but
to then decorate like it this like way.
Another architect is really, I think, a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Where they're just saying, like, okay, I want one like such and such, you know, like what they did, you know, 5 years ago or whatever. Now it's now it's like, okay, now everybody's gonna be using that same, you know, the same materials, the same, you know.
Yeah. That makes me think of an architect. Do you know Charles Ward? He's a Venice architect whose work I really admire.
Charles Ward.
He's probably in his late 70s, I'm guessing, and practicing still, but totally below the radar. You won't be able to find him anywhere on Google. But he's done some amazing work that is just completely principled, kind of warm modernism, or I think of it as like rustic minimalism. There's a great book called Marfa Modern, which is modern architecture in Marfa, Texas. That his work reminds me of. And what he has done, he's done a lot of remodels where he goes in and kind of exposes the framing and the old woodwork. But he does a very light touch. Like, it doesn't have to scream at you like the sculptural school of Southern California. And it's very gentle and minimalist and yet really warm and textured. And I was talking with him and he was talking about attaining a level of success to where he was, you know, working with some famous rock star who wanted him to do, you know, a Tuscan villa with, you know, some special, you know, stone countertops. And he was just like, I can't do this, you know, and basically just, you know, went back to being a carpenter and a painter, you know, because it's like people who follow their principles rather than house in the style of, like, oh, you want a Tuscan villa? Great, we can do Tuscan villa. I'm always intrigued by people who take, you know, the request for a Tuscan villa and then investigate, what is it that you're talking about? You know, oh, you're talking about fireplaces and wood, you know, decking and beams and outdoor gardens and courtyards and water features. Like, oh, okay, we can do that and we can make it into, you know, modern architecture, you know, like Sebastian Mariscal, maybe, you know, or, you know, somebody that's not applying postmodern stylistic motifs to space, but really reinterpreting ideas in contemporary form. Yeah. That's what intrigues me.
Yes, yes. So what do you like, what do you, you're not a fellow, right?
I am not.
Yes, yes. No. I have a fellow question, but I don't ask it if people are... I'm not a fellow either, and I'm not going to get fellow.
You never know. You never know. Who was telling me that... Oh, I know. Somebody was talking about Larry Scarpa encouraging them to be, you know, a fellow, and they became a fellow. You know, and he thought that he was sort of humble and, you know, that he didn't deserve it, but under Larry's tutelage and encouragement, really, he became a fellow. Yeah. So you never know. There's still time for you.
No, I'm not going to do it. No. Because you have to be in for 10 years. You have to be paying your dues, literally dues with the price tag, for 10 years. Okay. And I only came back into it like 4 years ago or something. And then, So, and I definitely don't want to be doing it like 6 or 10 years from now. I don't want to be applying for it because it's kind of... You know,
that's when you're just hitting your stride, you know, architects, like, you know, when did Frank Gehry become well-known? Like,
we talked about this in the last podcast, yeah. too, that, I mean, in your 50s, I mean, that's what you kind of have to explain to write to millennials and younger people that, you know, it's like, I keep saying that, like, Frank Gehry was in his 50s before, and it was the parking structures, right?
Right,
it was,
at the Santa Monica Place Mall.
So, and those other malls there.
Yeah.
I mean, right? I think he did those other parking structures, and they said, oh, okay, now you can do the mall because you did these two other parking structures. And I mean, until then, and so that was in his 50s, and I don't know. I don't have any Santa Monica parking structures in my portfolio. But, it just takes a long time. I mean, it's not like, I mean, there are people that are, that I guess kind of get fame younger or something and then just keep going, but
I mean, really, that's like part two answer to your question about why did I get into real estate. I mean, I had a hard time surviving as an architect,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I had gone from making, I don't remember what my salary was, as a retail sales analyst for corporate Pepsi,
mm-hmm.
you know, or a management consultant at Deloitte. I spent 4 years, you know, or five, taking prerequisites and then getting into a 3-year master's program, and then spending, you know, 10 years as a construction superintendent, because I was able to earn money as a construction worker, than more money than I could get in an architect's office.
Yeah.
I remember
yeah.
when I decided to get my NCARB certification, I needed a few more specific sign-offs. And mm-hmm. so I quit my construction job and took a 50% pay cut to go work for the highest paying architecture firm job that I could find, you know,
yeah.
in order to get those NCARB sign-offs.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I can't, you know, I came out of school $100,000 in debt, and, you know, I was ready to start a family,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't survive and practice architecture, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I might've had a different path had I been more committed to it, or, you know, it sort of makes me think of the architect Hugh Newell Jacobson.
Yeah.
And I did
yeah.
a really great house that he designed in Bel Air for the founder's son of Architectural Digest. He
mm-hmm.
built that into the magazine that it became and then sold it to Condé Nast and
mm-hmm.
commissioned Hugh Jacobson to do a beautiful house on the Bel Air golf course that was 17 pavilions clad in French limestone and English slate roofs and
uh-huh.
connected by water features. And Roy Lichtenstein designed 6 doors for the home, you know, that were like Swiss cheese bronze doors
yeah.
and really cool. And I remember asking Hugh Jacobson, I asked him 2 questions. I remember, you know, asking him how, well, this architecture was sort of neoclassical mm-hmm. in the sense that it was very modern. All the detailing was modern,
yeah.
but there were 17 pyramid shaped pavilions that had columns and arches, you
mm-hmm.
know, so it was definitely historically referential.
Yeah.
And so it was giving mixed messages. And I asked him, you know, Hugh, how would you describe the style of your architecture? And he looked at me in his sort of patrician Virginia accent, said, "Style, what a vulgar word, you know. My architecture is about people and parties and art and, you know." So I couldn't get him to really commit on, is this modern architecture or postmodern architecture? And then I also asked him, and I was like a year out of graduate school, I asked him, how did you become such a, you know, successful world famous architect? And he said, I married a very wealthy woman. And so I neither married a wealthy
yes.
woman nor had parents who could, you know, I really had to work for a living, and I was unable to survive in Los Angeles as an architect. And so real estate has allowed me to survive and, you know, still remain connected as an architecture broker to my love of architecture.
Yeah. Well, Brian, and also, I mean, you have a degree in business, so you're looking at it more from business. And had you not been making money before, you know, you wouldn't have known, right? It's like people that have never made a lot of money, and then they're, you know, and they're in architecture, and, you know, either they have family money or, you know, some other source of income. You know, it's like, it's just like, oh yeah, what's always like this? Like, why worry about bills or having any money or anything? Right. Or if you have it and it's taken away, you know, and all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, like
I was a late bloomer, you know, I didn't get out of architecture school until I was 31. And So I think if I had been 22 or 23 or something, maybe working for, as a free intern, you know, might have worked for me.
I never was a free intern, never. Yeah, never. Do not work for free. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. No, I never did. No.
What's a good thing? Always.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't work for, and you know, it's like I didn't work for any starchitects, really. I mean, well, that's probably the thing. I wouldn't have done it, right? I wouldn't have done it. Yeah. What would you like to say about the future of architecture?
Well, I hope it improves. I really do, because I think that by and large, we live in a really ugly world, you know? I mean, Los Angeles is one of the ugliest cities on the planet, you know? Whenever I come back from Europe or somewhere, like the old Europe, you know? I mean, certainly there's not an uglier city than Paris, France, outside
France,
the walls of...
Yeah, exactly.
Little medieval village. Yeah. But I'm always shocked that arriving at LAX and kind of driving up the 405, like, wow, this is like a vast wasteland of nothing. And yet, within that, it's a treasure trove. It's the mecca for modern architecture. Mm-hmm. And so I can sing, you know, talk out of both sides of my mouth that I think Los Angeles is one of the most beautiful cities on the planet in certain places, you know. And unfortunately, there's not a big demand for architecture. I mean, I remember being in architecture school, and the first thing they said to us was, look around. You know, none of you are going to be architects. Like, maybe five of you are going to be architects. And
at UCLA graduate school?
At UCLA graduate
school.
Really? They said, like, maybe 10% of you will be
practicing
architects.
I mean, I can see, like, that in the undergrad program. But, I mean, typically, like, with the graduate programs, people are a little bit more focused, right? They're not going to be like, oh, I don't want to do architecture. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, typically you're older. You're like, you
right.
know,
you have to make a change to come back and do
exactly.
this.
And,
no, but they sort of scared us off. And then the other thing that they said was, how many, you know, what percentage of buildings in the United States do you suppose involve architects or were designed by architects? I mean, do you, if you were to guess.
No, I don't. You know, Brian, we just talked about this. No,
okay.
Mark and I
what
just
did Mark
talked about
say, what
yeah,
did you guys,
5%.
No, it's nowhere near 5%.
Really? It's even
it's less?
Less
than 2%.
Okay, so he had said that in school it was 5% when he was in school.
At
so
UCLA,
probably,
they told us 2%.
But, okay.
As an architecture broker looking at homes that come on the multiple listing service, it's less than a half of 1%. So there's no demand for architecture. Most people don't know what it is. Most people don't know how to spell architecture or say architecture.
Yeah.
You know, I love it when people are like architectural with a W, you know, or they like, they don't really don't know what architects do. They sort of get it. But I mean, I think there's very little demand, and certainly magazines like Dwell and Wallpaper, and there, you know, there is a higher consciousness of design, but it's not a mass produced, commodity like cars or something where, you know, you're turning on the television and watching ads about, wouldn't it be great to live in architecture?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very rarefied, I can't afford to live in architecture, you know? I mean, I own a little piece of architecture that I built in Austin, but it's like, you know, you can't buy architecture in this town for under $3 million.
No.
And that's, you know, two people earning, you know, $350,000 a year and like getting by on $700,000 a year, and you can buy your little, you know, starter A. Quincy Jones fixer in Crestwood Hills. You know, so I don't know. I mean, I hope architecture.
I actually worked for her for like 1 week. I mean, I
for
knew
Corey
her.
Buckley.
Yeah.
Okay.
I knew her. I only worked for her for like 3 to 5. I mean, I don't know whether she ever listened to the podcast anyway, but I worked for her for
shout out to Corey.
Week. Yeah. Yeah, I worked for her for 1 week, and the thing is that I had been up, and I've like written about it before too. I just haven't said her name. I did post a picture of the book though, But yeah, I was there for it because she used to work for Mark.
Oh, really? For Mark Appleton?
Yeah, she used to work for Mark Appleton. So she had been there, and I think we had even house sat one time for her and for her and her husband, and we
Nick.
Yes, Nick. And then they. I was down in San Diego because it was during a recession, and you know they said, "Oh, okay, you know Corey like needs somebody to draft for." So I went up. I started working for her, and then halfway through the week, she said, "Oh, how much do you charge per hour?" Right? And at that time, which I think, I mean, like this was only I was not an employee; I was a consultant, and it was $12, right? $12, and I was like, what, like 1 year out of school? Because I had a lot of drafting experience. I started working for an architect in my second year of architecture school.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And I drafted in high school also. I was in like a drafting program. So I was a pretty good drafter. Okay. I still am a pretty good drafter because I still hand draft everything. But you know, we got towards the end of the week, and then, you know, and she didn't say anything, right? And then at the end of the week, she said, okay, you don't need to, you know, it's like, I'll call you when I need you. And I was like, oh, okay. And then, yeah. And so I basically got laid off. I was
you
like,
too expensive.
I was too expensive for 1 week. She did ask if I could draft a little bit faster, but you know, the thing is also, it's like, there's only so much. And these were for these people in the entertainment industry. I mean, she was doing this project for these people in the entertainment industry, and you know, with a lot of the, I mean, with the woman that I worked for, I mean, and Corey, they were drafting was not their forte. I mean, I have to say that. So with both of them, there are these people, you know, when you're hand drafting and you like put it underneath, and, you know, it's like they don't line up the with the parallel. So it's like everything is off. And, you know, of course, with those, you know, with the 80s and 90s with these like slight angled things where it's like, okay, is this a slight angle on this project or is this actually
it's just a slip.
Yeah. But anyway, that's my Corey Buckner story.
I saw Corey Love recently. Corey. Yes. We had every now and then I'll rent out Case Study 22 to watch the sunset and have a small group of friends up there. And Corey joined us in April. And as a little thank you gift, she sent me this book called The Lyman House and the Work of Frederick P. Lyman. I actually didn't know of him or his house. And this was a house that he designed in Tuna Canyon in Malibu that was really magical and sadly burned down in the 94 fire, but very inspired by
Corey's house burned down.
Right. I forget if that one hers burned down twice.
Yes,
you know, and so those were sad stories.
Yeah.
But yeah, Corey, I really respect and admire. And it's funny that you mention her because I've just been reading this book, which is wonderful.
Did she write that one then?
She did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and she also gave me two books, and the second one, A Cambridge Modernist. The Architecture of David Wynne Roberts, who I didn't know either. But
I didn't know she wrote all these.
Quite
books.
Prolific as an author. You know, she's written the Crestwood Hills books and the A. Quincy Jones books.
Yeah.
But I'm excited to have received both of those from her.
Yes.
But I hope architecture becomes more relevant. You know, I hope that architects are able to reposition themselves. And, you know, I see it with, you know, architects who have gone on to work with companies like IDEO and Frog Design, where they're influencing design in other environments. But I think that it's really, I think, a battle to hold on to our relevance, the relevance of our architects as, you know, projects become builder driven, you know, design build projects are most often driven by the builder, not the architect.
And
so I hope that architecture remains relevant because there's so many, you know, millions of stories of people whose lives have been influenced positively by architecture, you know, what it's like growing up in an environment that was thought out and well conceived.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. visiting a public building that is designed with the user in mind. And so I think architecture is kind of like a quasi-spiritual experience that can be very influential.
And yeah.
So
yeah.
I have faith that architecture will prevail and become more influential.
Yes, with the value of architecture.
That's right. Yes. That is part of my mission, actually.
Yeah.
Is really promoting the value of good design in the built environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I tell architects, and this is like an open invitation to you and every other architect, that mm-hmm. when you're meeting with clients and you're starting to get estimates on how much it's going to cost to build the design that you've conceived, mm-hmm. bring me in and I'll do a free valuation of the project and try to help the owners understand the value that's being added by the design, you know, because yeah. I'm always selling the most expensive house in the neighborhood, whatever it is, because if it's well designed and well conceived, it doesn't necessarily have to even be by a famous architect with a capital A, but good design always adds value if it's done right.
No, exactly. And I mean, that's kind of like what I do a lot of addition remodels, and I kind of go, okay, before and after, you know, and how much, you know, how much more valuable the property is after we work on it. Of course, we have to try to figure out some way that we can gain that interest in the project.
I know. Sadly, it's not like the music business where you get royalties or...
I mean, I guess NFTs are like that, supposedly, right?
NFTs.
Yeah.
I think people have tried to... Dion Neutra, Richard Neutra's son, was sort of famous for trying to record conservation easements on Neutra-designed properties that would have given him a monthly stipend to make sure that they kept it pristine and in Neutra form. But I don't know if he was ever successful in actually getting any of those recorded. Yeah, it's unfortunate that the artists... But it's like that in the secondary art market, too. I mean, artists who sell paintings, those paintings are resold on the secondary art market at huge profits. So, you know, it's the architecture... real estate market is similar to the contemporary or the fine art secondary market.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that makes me feel a little bit less...
less taken advantage of. You have to become an architect developer like Jonathan Siegel.
That is what I want to do.
Sebastian Mariscal.
I absolutely do want to do that. Yeah. All I need is a benefactor.
That's the only problem. I know.
All it is money, my friend. It's just money. Yeah, no, I'd be more than happy to do that. No, I'm doing 4 houses right now for somebody, and it's like, okay, I could be doing this if I had 4, you know, right?
Yeah.
So, maybe not in Southern California, probably.
It's hard to be a developer here now. And it's especially risky for architects because I've seen architects go bankrupt, literally, doing projects that were designed as though they were going to live in them personally. And then
you have to really eat into that profit margin. Yes,
so it's a fine line. I mean, people are willing to pay a super premium in many cases for great design, but it costs a lot to build great design. Mm-hmm. So it's finding that sweet spot.
Yeah.
It's risky. Yeah. I have decided it doesn't make sense for me to be a developer. It's too risky, you know, because I don't want to do lowest common denominator cement board ADUs and, you know, just like the kind of flip stuff that I see going on in this neighborhood where developers take a historic home, gut it, and open up the floor plan and put in these fake gray floors you know, can lights and, you know, quartz countertops. And it's like sort of whatever was on sale at Home Depot. That's what's successful for developers for the most part. Otherwise, they would be doing more interesting
stuff. No building permit and 30-day, you know, 30 to 60-day turnaround.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. They're just bringing everything through the back door.
Yeah.
The trucks go into the back, down the driveway.
Right, down the alley.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. We know what you're doing. Yeah. Okay, Brian, anything else?
That's all I can think of. It's been so nice to hang out with you and talk with you about architecture and other things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I
appreciate your hospitality.
Oh, I appreciate your hospitality. Yeah, this has better. This is better than trying to do it in a coffee house or something like that. Yeah, yeah. A restaurant. Yeah,
can get a little noisy.
Yeah, definitely. You can still make me a cup of coffee though.
Would you like one?
Sure. Well, I mean, not during the thing. I'll like turn off the.
We can make some coffee grinding noises.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Michelle.